Chapter 20. Juan Cabrillo had never known such pain. It wasn't the sharp agony of having his legs shot off by a Chinese gunboat, but an overall ache that cramped all his muscles until he was certain he couldn't go on. His thighs and back took the brunt of the strain of paraskiing, and they felt like they were burning from within. His hands were formed into claws that gripped the chute's toggles, and there was no way to rest them. There was no way to rest any part of his body unless he quit. And that wasn't an option. So long as the wind continued to blow across the desert, Cabrillo grimly hung on to his chute and raced over the sand. His turns were no longer crisp, and when he fell, it took him longer and longer to get to his feet. He hadn't taken a single break since his sat phone had chimed and Max Hanley had told him Eddie, Mike, and Ski had been captured. From what Link could hear over the radio when his teammates had been discovered, there was a contingent of troops from Zimbabwe at the Devil's Oasis guarding that country's opposition leader, Moses Ndebele. Linda had done some quick research and learned that Ndebele was to be tried for crimes against the state in a couple of days and would most likely be executed. The UN's formal complaint against Zimbabwe had done nothing except cause the government to further restrict freedoms within their borders. The entire country was under martial law, and a dusk-to-dawn curfew was in effect in Harare, the capital. Linda learned that Ndebele had a large following that crossed tribal lines. His was the first opposition movement that had the slightest chance of overthrowing Zimbabwe's corrupt government and establishing a democracy in what had once been one of Africa's wealthiest countries, but was now ravaged by famine and disease. Though once a fierce guerrilla leader when Zimbabwe was known as Rhodesia and was governed with an apartheid-like system by its white minority government, Moses Ndebele advocated a non-violent approach to toppling the current regime, and Linda found numerous comparisons to Gandhi. Max had already passed the information to Langston Overholt. Lang had said just finding Ndebele was an intelligence coup and added that if the corporation could rescue him, it would go a long way to shore up America's position in southern Africa. It was too soon to mention a price, but Lang assured Max that the bounty to get Ndebele to safety would run into the millions. Max had also reported that it appeared Susan Dunleavy hadn't been kidnapped at all. She was a willing accomplice to Jeffrey Merrick's abduction and had put a bullet into the scientist's chest when she had the chance. Link didn't know the severity of the injury. With the rest of his men captured and being threatened with a dawn execution, Link had asked what Max wanted him to do. The guards would sweep the entire prison and find him within minutes. He could try to fight it out or make his escape on one of the dirt bikes. "What did you tell him?" Juan had asked. "What do you think?" "He must have hated leaving them, but it's the right move." Juan had known that was the only viable option. "He's one pissed hombre." "Are you tracking him?" "He's about 20 miles from where Tiny set down the plane and making about 30 miles per hour on one of the bikes. And for your information, you've covered about 40 miles so far." The idea was ludicrous, but Cabrillo had to ask. "How far am I from the plane?" "Over 150, Max had told him. Dawn would hit long before he covered half that distance, and when it arrived, Juan would have to hole up or risk dehydration. The other alternative was to find some place where Tiny could land close by, but so far Cabrillo had seen nothing but soft dunes incapable of supporting even a light plane, let alone the twin-engine cargo aircraft they had rented for the drop. "If Link wasn't followed," Juan said, "I want him to wait with Tiny and Hux."
"You have a plan?"
"No. I'm just positioning assets for when I do come up with something." Neither man doubted Juan would. That had been 2 hours ago, two of the longest of Cabrillo's life. He eased up on the right toggle when the wind shifted and flew over the top of a sand dune, catching air for nearly 30 seconds before returning to Earth. He absorbed the impact with protesting knees and barreled down the far side of the dune. The tire tracks had been to his right, but with the change in wind direction, he was soon running along them and then slightly to their left. He prepared to tack as he was dragged up another towering mountain of sand, the tallest yet. His momentum dropped as the wind fought the friction of the plastic plate against the sand, and he had to struggle to keep from being yanked off his feet. He was more exhausted than he'd ever been in his life, a punch-drunk tired that dulled his reflexes and made his mind crave sleep above anything else. The chute continued to slow, forcing him to lean back so far that his body was bent double and his butt was almost touching the ground. Just when it felt the wind would abandon him altogether and force him to slog the rest of the way up the hill, a gust snatched the chute and lifted Cabrillo off his feet and over the dune's summit. To his horror, he saw four trucks arranged at the base of the dune so that their headlights shone on a fifth that had its long hood opened. Men were clustered around the disabled vehicle, with two of them standing on the bumper and leaning into the engine compartment. Several of them cradled assault rifles. Juan had wanted to approach the vehicles carefully and determine who they were and what they were doing this far out in the desert before making contact. The gust that had mercifully carried him over the crest of the hill was going to drop him right in the middle of their lager. He hastily dumped the air from his chute and fell back to earth in the vain hope he could scramble back over the dune before he was spotted. He landed in the soft sand and immediately pitched forward, cartwheeling down the face of the hill in a tangle of nylon and riser lines. He hit the base of the dune with the parachute wrapped around his body as tightly as a mummy's bindings, his mouth and nostrils full of sand. Cabrillo spat and blew to clear his airways, but no matter how he struggled, he couldn't free either arm to cut away the nylon. He watched helplessly as four of the men ran from their camp, their AK-47s held low and at the ready.
"Hiya, boys," Juan called cheerfully when they were within earshot. "Any chance you could lend me a hand here?"
After being stripped of their weapons, radios, and gear, Eddie, Mike, and Ski were dumped into adjoining cells in the block the Zimbabwean soldiers were using to guard Moses and Debele. Jeffrey Merrick had been taken by a group of civilians who matched what Eddie thought a bunch of environmentalist fanatics would look like. You couldn't discern their gender by judging hair length alone. The stench of patchouli oil barely masked the odor of marijuana that permeated their clothes. Eddie massaged his jaw where Susan Dunleavy had sucker-punched him after her friends had woken her. A guard who'd seen the blow walked by his cage at that moment, saw what he was doing, and smirked. Eddie estimated there were about 100 armed men in the prison, and now that the adrenaline had been flushed from his body and he'd had time to think through his situation, he understood why there were so many. Moses Ndebele was seen by many as a potential savior of his country. The ruling regime would do anything to silence him. If they held him in a prison in Zimbabwe, it would become a rallying point for his followers. But out here, nobody knew where to find him. They could hold him indefinitely. He wondered about Merrick and Ndebele being here at the same time and assumed there was a connection, but couldn't see what it was. Daniel Singer must have made some sort of deal with the government of Zimbabwe to use the old prison, or vice versa. A couple of hours had passed since they'd been discovered. Because Link hadn't been brought to the cell block, that meant the former SEAL must have gotten away on one of the bikes. Eddie was relieved. The officer in charge of the garrison had announced that the corporation team would be executed at dawn. There was no sense in Link sacrificing himself needlessly if he had a chance to escape. But with the chairman stuck out in the desert, Lincoln on his own except for Tiny Gunderson and Doc Huxley, and the Oregon more than 200 miles away, Eddie conceded the chance of rescue was slim. They would need a fleet of helicopters to pull off an aerial assault, and the only vehicle currently aboard ship was Link's Harley, so crossing the desert was out. Eddie had gone into the CIA immediately after college and spent the majority of the next 15 years flying into and out of China, cultivating a network of informants who in turn allowed the United States to maintain its uneasy relationship with the mainland. He'd been inserted via a submarine onto Hainan in the spring of 2001 when the Chinese were holding the crew of an EP-3 spy plane and passed on information that kept the crisis from becoming a war. He'd maneuvered around China's secret police, one of the most efficient in the world, with near impunity because he was so good at what he did. The irony of being caught by a third-rate dictator's Praetorian guards wasn't lost on him. Despite the odds, Eddie still had faith that Juan Cabrillo would find a way to save them. Though the two served in the CIA at the same time, they hadn't met until after leaving government service. That didn't mean Eddie hadn't heard of Cabrillo. Juan had single-handedly pulled off some of the most difficult assignments in the agency's history. And because he was fluent in Spanish, Arabic, and Russian, his missions had been in some of the toughest countries on Earth. He was a bit of a legend at Langley. His reputation, along with his white blonde hair, had earned him the nickname Mr. Phelps, the lead character from the old Mission Impossible television show. Whether tracking drug smugglers from Colombia into Panama or infiltrating a terrorist group in Syria planning to blow up the Israeli Knesset with a hijacked airliner, Cabrillo had done it all. So if anyone was able to spring them from this hellhole with only a couple of hours to go before dawn and limited resources, Eddie was sure Juan was the man. A flashlight beam stabbed out of the darkness and blinded Cabrillo. Behind the glare, he distinctly heard the sound of rifle bolts being cocked back. He held still. The next few seconds would determine if he lived or died. One of the men moved closer, covering Juan with a massive revolver, an old Webley, if he wasn't mistaken. The man was older than Juan, pushing 50, with white shooting through the tight curls on his head and wrinkles lining his forehead. "Who are you?" he asked suspiciously. "My name is Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo." Judging by the man's age, the fact they were all armed, and that they were headed in the general direction of the Devil's Oasis, Juan gambled his life by saying, "I want to help you rescue Moses Ndebele." The man's fist tightened around the antique pistol, his dark eyes unreadable in the shifting light. Juan plunged on, praying he was right about the identity of this group. "Three of my men are at the prison now, trying to rescue an American businessman when they were captured by troops guarding Ndebele. One of my guys managed to escape and is waiting with an aircraft about 40 miles from the prison. If I'm going to save my people, I am willing to help you save your leader." The gun remained rock steady. "How did you find us?" "My main parachute fouled, and when I was drifting down on the reserve here, I saw your headlights. I jury-rigged a periski and have been following you." "Your story is just strange enough to be true." The man lowered his pistol and said something in a native dialect. Another of the Africans stepped forward and withdrew a knife from his pocket. "Just so you know, I have a Glock automatic in a holster and an MP5 machine pistol strapped around my back." The man with the knife glanced at the group leader. He nodded, and the second African cut a slit into the nylon, allowing Juan to take his first deep breath since tumbling down the dune. He stood slowly, keeping his arm well away from the holstered Glock. "Thank you," he said, and extended his hand.
Please call me Juan.
Mafana, the headman said, and clasped Cabrillo's thumb in a traditional greeting.
What do you know of our Baba, our father, Moses Ndebele?
I know that he is to be tried and executed very soon, and if that happens, any chances of you overthrowing your government are gone.
He is the first leader to unite both major tribes in Zimbabwe, the Matabele and the Mashona, Mafana said. During our War of Independence, he held the rank of general before the age of 30. But after the war, the ruling elite saw his popularity as a threat to their power. He has been imprisoned and tortured often. They have had him in custody this time for 2 years and will kill him if we do not rescue him.
How many men do you have?
30. All of us served with Moses.
Juan looked at the men's faces. None of them were under 40, yet there was a lean hunger in their eyes, a measure of confidence of men who had tasted combat that made the years since irrelevant.
Can you fix your vehicle? He asked, taking a step forward, but forgetting he was still attached to the main chute's plastic backplate.
He promptly fell on his face. A couple of the men chuckled. Chagrined, Cabrillo turned around so he was sitting and pulled up his pants leg. The chuckles died on their lips when they saw the gleaming artificial leg. He yanked it off, saying, "Just think of it as the biggest Swiss Army knife in the world." The laughter returned. Mafana helped Juan to stand and gave him an arm to steady him as he hopped across the soft sand toward the temporary camp.
To answer your question, yes, it can be fixed. Dirt has entered the fuel pump and stopped it from working. We should be ready to go in another few minutes, but we have lost a great deal of time.
Juan borrowed a hammer and chisel from a blanket strewn with tools laid out next to the disabled truck and got to work freeing his prosthesis from the plastic plate.
How are you going to free Ndebele? We are going to lay an ambush outside the prison and wait for them to transfer Moses away. They may use trucks, but we suspect it will be an aircraft. Rumor in our capital is that the trial is in 2 days.
Which would be too late to save my guys, Juan thought. He also thought Mafana's ambush idea would guarantee a bullet to Ndebele's head the moment they engaged the guards. He had to find a way to get Mafana to attack the Devil's Oasis before dawn, or Eddie, Mike, and Ski were dead men.
What if I had a plan to free Moses tonight and fly him to safety in South Africa?
The former guerrilla regarded Cabrillo sagely.
I would like to know more about this plan.
So would I, Juan muttered to himself, knowing he had just a few moments to come up with something.
First, let me ask you, do you have any rocket-propelled grenades?
Old Russian RPG-7s left over from the war. Juan groaned. Zimbabwe's Revolutionary War had ended 25 years ago.
Do not worry, Mafana added quickly. They've been tested.
What about rope? How much rope do you have?
Mafana asked one of his men for the answer and translated for Juan.
A great deal, it seems. At least 2,000 feet of nylon line.
And one final question, Juan said, looking back at where his cut-up parachute fluttered in the wind as inspiration hit him like a thunderbolt.
Any of you guys know how to sew?